All right, we are returning to our study of the fifth commandment of the moral law, honor your father and your mother. And we are particularly considering now the honor which inferiors owe to their superiors, the honor that inferiors owe to their superiors. And what we have discovered in our catechism is the first thing is that's mentioned is that inferiors owe their superiors reverence. That is an important part of the honor that is due unto the superior. And we defined reverence as a sort of respect, feeling or attitude of deep respect tinged with awe. And that is in the recognition of another as a superior. So reverence, a feeling or attitude of deep respect tinged with awe. And you remember last week that we said that with respect to this moral obligation, the reverence that is that we're to have for our superiors, it is a reverence which is both to be felt and also to be expressed. Reverence of the heart, but also reverence of word and behavior. So that's where we'll pick up today. What I want to talk about first this morning is reverence as a moral good. Let's remember that this is a discussion of Christian ethics. So when we talk about reverence for superiors, we're not merely speaking of something which is a cherished tradition that we don't want to lose for that reason alone, because it is a tradition that we cherish. We're not talking about something which is merely practical, like weatherproofing your house by caulking your windows because it lowers your power bill. We're talking about morality here, which means that we're talking about love, a sort of love that that we owe unto others, and particularly in this relationship between inferiors and superiors. When we are the inferiors, we owe our superiors the love, the honor of reverence. It is something which we are to both feel and also something which we are to express by our words and behavior. So in what way is reverence a moral good? I think it's worth discussing that for a moment, because I suspect that insofar as we do think of reverence, which is probably not much these days, when we do, we probably don't think of it as a matter of morality. But that's precisely what we are being taught here in the Larger Catechism, that it is honoring our superiors is a moral good. And so I see three ways in which reverence is a moral good that I want you to consider today. And if you see another, you can let me know. First, remember that superiors are an ordinance of God. And that it's God in His providence who calls and appoints certain individuals to the role of superiors. And we saw last week that God in the Bible commands us to revere these individuals that we call our superiors. We are both to feel reverence for them, and we are to express reverence to them by our words and our behavior. And so that being the case, the first way that reverence is a moral good is that it's obedience to God. It is submission unto His will. And because we know that it is our God's will to freely, to cheerfully render the honor of reverence unto our superiors. In that way, reverence is a moral good, of course. Secondly, though, reverence is goodwill towards our superior. Okay, it is if we revere your superior is to accept that God has given this role to another person, to recognize the honor that belongs to that calling, and to in love freely accept that and to be happy for that person that God has given them that role and has given them that honor. Respect the burden of it that individual bears, and want them to do well in it. That's a big part of what reverence is, and that's where it begins to look like just love for one's neighbor, doing unto another what you would want them to do to you if the roles were reversed. So another way to think about this is that the opposite of reverence towards our superiors is envy. When we envy someone because they are superior, we don't want to give them the honor that is due unto them. We resent the fact that they are a superior to us and are esteemed to be worthy of honors that maybe we do not receive. And so when the ugliness of envy enters into our hearts, we don't want to pay them that honor. We don't want to acknowledge that is due unto them. And so in various ways, we refuse to yield that. So envy is a sin. It's an ugly sin, and reverence in this respect is sort of its opposite. It is the absence of envy, so we're free to love and honor those whom God says such love and honor is due. Thirdly, reverence is, and I suggested this last week, of benefit to society. Remember that God has ordained superiors for our good. And that in a couple of ways. One, the role of superior is part of God's order in the world. It's a hierarchy. So we know who the leaders are. And so that is a good that's beneficial to us all to have an ordered society under the leadership of certain individuals as leaders. That helps us to work together instead of being in a constant power struggle and working against each other. And the other good thing for society about the role of superiors is that the tendency is to give these roles of leadership to the people who are most capable. That's not always the case in our world, but that's the general tendency. So if you take, for example, the relationship between parents and children, there's a rare occasion where probably the family would be better off if the children were in charge. But usually that's not the case. Usually the parents, for whatever their faults are in fact better suited, more capable of making decisions on behalf of the family. So it's good that they should be acknowledged as the superiors in that case. And I think that that's true generally. Through this sort of order that God ordains, we tend to wind up with the people who ought to be speaking doing the speaking. And those people who ought to be making the important decisions, whether these are superiors in age or gift or authority. That's the general tendency, and that's for everybody's good. So reverence, then, is one important way in which all the inferiors support this that God has ordained for our common good. Rather than denying these superiors, it's acknowledging them. Rather than resisting their authority, their right to be the one to speak, their right to be the one to make the decisions, we are encouraging that. We're encouraging the leaders in their role, giving unto them our support and saying, yes, you're the superior, you speak, you lead us. And also we're encouraging the other inferiors around us to do the same. So reverence is the role of the inferiors to help support this order in society, which God has ordained, which is for everybody's good. And then the last thing that I would mention is that reverence is a moral good when you consider that this is part of what we owe to God as a superior, right? By learning to and then freely showing reverence towards the superiors among us in this world, that sort of trains us, encourages us to likewise show reverence unto God. If we were to come to a place in our lives where we no longer felt that it was necessary for us to show reverence to our superiors among the human race, and we were no longer willing to do so, and we never did so, it's worth asking what would become of showing reverence toward God. Would we feel that was something that we ought to do? Would we be comfortable with that? Would we even know how to do that if reverence died out among us as as the human race. So the reverence shown to superiors under the second table of the law is just sort of a subcategory of the reverence that we show to God under the first table of the law. That's the third commandment. You should not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So these are all ways, I think, in which reverence might be considered and appreciated to be a moral good. Anything you'd add to that list? Okay, so as I thought about this this week, I remember when I was a kid, probably 7th or 8th grade, there was a new television show that debuted, about which there was a good bit of excitement and not a little bit of controversy. It was a cartoon, but it was a cartoon that was going to air in prime time, because it was this was what was unique about it. It was not just a cartoon for children; it was also a cartoon for adults. It had that adult edge to it. Maybe you know what cartoon I'm thinking about. It's The Simpsons, right? and one of the main characters, probably the main character in the Simpson family, was the boy, and his name was Bart Simpson. And what was Bart Simpson? Who is this character? What was it that made him interesting and entertaining? Well, if you're familiar with the show, the really defining character of Bart Simpson is that he was irreverent, right? His catchphrase, which was on all the t-shirts, was "Eat my shorts, man." All right, that was it. That was his shtick. And what you understand is that when in Bart Simpson saying this as a little boy, he was saying it to his dad, and he was saying it to his mom, and he was saying it to police officers, and he was saying it to his teacher and his principal, and he was saying it to the mayor. Okay, it didn't matter where Bart Simpson went; he was always irreverent to the people that we normally think of as being his superiors, and. The thing about The Simpsons, part of the reason that there was so much excitement about the show is that the people who created it were quite gifted. They really were talented people. So in terms of entertainment, it was a quality show. So it had the potential to be quite popular, and in fact it was. It ran for years and years and years and years and always had really good ratings. I watched it myself. A lot of you probably did as well. But I remember at the time, particularly when it first came out, there was some concern expressed about this character, Bart Simpson. And the concern was, what effect is this going to have upon our society if this character becomes as popular as we anticipate that he will become? What if the people watching this show began to admire and emulate Bart Simpson? What if all our children become as irreverent as this character Bart Simpson? And what happens when those children grow up and become adults? What happens to our world? So now we're, I don't know, 15, 20 years, no longer than that, 20 years out from that. And I think in retrospect, we can see those were not unfounded concerns. The chickens have come home to roost. While we were enjoying and being entertained by The Simpsons, something important was being destroyed in our society, and something immoral was happening in our souls. So this is kind of where we are. That's sort of my lead-in to talking about this character of our society now, as Americans in the 21st century. There are any number of societies, most societies in the history of the world certainly, and still many in the world today, that truly value reverence. It's a virtue, and reverence shown towards superiors is something that is expected of people. We think of the Eastern societies like the Chinese and the Japanese. This is still, for the most part, pretty strong in those cultures. So American culture, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, was quite unique in this respect. Not the norm, but something quite abnormal, in that we actually turned the opposite direction. We began to see reverence as something bad. We began to see reverence as something to mock and to ridicule, something to suppress, something to say to people, you don't have to do that. Don't call me Mr. So-and-so, call me John, Right? I grew up around that all the time, and that was just sort of an idea that we had kind of embraced and was being promoted on all kinds of fronts. How did this happen? How did our culture come to be a culture which began to regard reverence not as a virtue but as a vice, not as something to expect of people, but something to say, I don't expect that from you. I think it goes back to modernism, which we talked about in our church history class. Remember that modernism, as we're moving out of the 19th century into the 20th century, was a movement that it saw it as one of its goals to destroy all of the traditional conventions and structures of Western society. And I think that the modernists recognize that if you're gonna do that, then you have to destroy reverence for those things. You're not gonna get people to rise up and destroy traditional conventions if they feel that those conventions are something which ought to be revered. So you have to attack reverence itself in order to bring about a popular uprising that will willingly destroy these sorts of things. So I think it was of the nature of modernism to be irreverent. I don't think it's hard to demonstrate that when you go back and look at that intellectual movement that was very much at work at the beginnings of the 20th century. So this modern irreverence, though, it doesn't happen overnight. It's not something that you can't get people to go from reverence to irreverence overnight. So it took some time for this to develop. But it finally broke out on a popular level when? 1960s, right? There was a cultural revolution in the 1960s, which we associate with the hippies, but it was a lot broader than that. And if you look at the cultural revolution of the 1960s, this was no doubt really at the core of the character of that cultural revolution, is that this was a movement that was intentionally and wholeheartedly determined to be irreverent towards anything which traditionally had been an object of reverence. Now, like most cultural or social movements, particularly in this day and age, there was art that accompanied the movement itself. For in the 1960s, in that cultural revolution, the most important art form was music. And what was the music that went along with, that was supportive of and communicative of the irreverence of this particular cultural revolution? We call it rock and roll. And so as you think about this, those of you who are familiar with rock and roll, and I'm completely familiar with it, I grew up on it, I would say that it is of the essence of rock and roll music to be irreverent. That's why it was the handmaiden of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. Whatever it is that you might say about rock and roll music, it is always irreverent in spirit. So much so that if it ever became reverent, it would cease to be rock and roll. It would be something else. That's what I mean when I say it's of the essence. Sometimes it can be lighthearted. Sometimes it can be quite serious. Sometimes it can be angry. Sometimes it can be this. There's lots of variability within rock and roll. But it is not a means of expressing reverence for anything at any time, I would say. If you found an example of a rock and roll song that seemed to express reverence, I would call it an anomaly and something that deserved an entirely different category. Yes, sir.
Now we have churches that are full of rock and roll music.
That would seem to be a problem.
In a sanctuary and big drums.
Right, and we'll get to that. The other thing that happened with the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s is there was a new attitude, and it came up with a name for the new attitude to show, you know, this person or this group or whatever possesses the attitude of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, and the word to describe that attitude was cool. Again, I would say it's of the essence of cool to be irreverent. Cool is part apathetic, part angry, part rebellious, but in all things it expresses in its look, in its appearance, in its posture, in its response to people, I don't revere you. I don't revere you. I do what I want to do. Right? You don't bother me. I'm not going to cow to you. It's cool, right? Is cool reverent? Wouldn't reverence be sort of the antithesis to cool? So it all goes hand in hand. And so this became a popular movement in the 1960s. Well, now here we are, several generations later. We are in the second decade of the 21st century, and the irreverence that's taken hold in this country has not abated one bit. If anything, it might actually be getting worse now than it ever has been. So we see generally in our culture irreverence towards superiors in age. That's pretty much gone, right? In fact, if there's any tendency nowadays, it's really to hold young people in higher esteem than old people. Because young people embody what we value most, not the old people. That's new. That's different. But it's taken a deep hold of our minds and our souls in America in the 21st century. There is a degree of irreverence towards superiors in gifts. You see this in the modern classroom, where these old hippie professors are now having to live with the monster that they created. And they don't get much reverence from their students in the classroom. The students are much more interested in talking than hearing the professor speak. So this is kind of what they wanted. Don't call me Dr. So-and-so, call me Bob. Well, now Bob's getting it. From all his arrogant 19-year-old students. and lastly, irreverence towards superiors in authority. And this might be the most hostile of all. The egalitarian spirit is passionately anti-authority, both authority in the home, wives with respect to their husbands, children with respect to their parents. Also under this heading, we include the workplace. Employees with respect to their employees. It's true within the church as well, and it is true in the Commonwealth. And that's plain enough from watching the presidential circus to which we are being subjected right now. So it's really breathtaking if you go back, even 75 years. To see how this spirit of irreverence that was a part of the leading edge of modernism as a cultural social movement, it's just like leaven that has infected everything in society. We are thoroughly irreverent. So the other question I want to ask this morning is, what are the consequences? What are the consequences when a society, when a people begin to see reverence not as a virtue but as a vice, not as something to be taught, to be promoted, to be expected among the members of society, but something to be ridiculed and suppressed? If it is indeed a moral good for inferiors to show reverence to their superiors, what happens when we lose that? I'll mention a few things, and these just kind of flow logically from these categories that we looked at. One, when we go from reverence to irreverence, then we can expect to see in our society a heightened degree of rebellion and disorder. Okay, because remember that the superiors exist for this. They are ordained of God as part of the order of society. And reverence is the acceptance of that. Reverence is the submission unto that order, and the individuals who represent leadership under that order. And so if it feels like there is a degree of chaos in society, I mean, I don't mean that there's riots breaking out in the streets. Occasionally that happens, but for the most part, we live in an ordered society. But on a whole nother level, right? In the marriage, in the home, in the classroom, in the public discourse about our political leaders and so forth and so on. There's just this troubling sense of chaos. And if you look closely at the chaos, part of what it is just sort of this this angry, defiant, rebellious, uninhibited assault of the inferiors upon the honor of the superiors. It seems to it seems like we've just opened the floodgates onto this, and what we're actually we say that we're attacking corruption or we're attacking something like that that's gone on in the past, but really a significant part of what we're attacking is the order itself. It's revolutionary. It's an attempt. It was the 1960s were a cultural revolution, and it's still revolutionary. It seeks to overthrow the existing order and replace it with something else. In this case, sort of this utopian idea of egalitarianism, which will never happen. So that's one of the consequences. That's pretty significant. When you think about the effect upon people's lives in general, when the order begins to break down, God's order, and as a result, we fall into this disorder. That reverence was a constant acknowledgement of and reinforcement of the order that God had ordained. It was the inferiors communicating to the superiors, "You're the superiors. You're the guys who ought to be in charge. You're the guys who are in charge. You have the authority. It's yours to lead. We're going to show you reverence. Behave yourself in a way which is reverent." Right? That was an important part of making it work. And at the same time, it was communicating that to all of the other inferiors around. There's the shows of reverence, not just the feeling in the heart, but the manner of speech and the manner of behavior. It was all important for us as a society to acknowledge and to reinforce the existing order for the good of everybody. We lose reverence. When it begins to be viewed as a vice, as an undesirable, as something which is not necessary, then something important begins to collapse. Second consequence would be the stoking of the sin of envy. again, envy is the opposite of reverence with respect to superiors. And envy is not something that takes lightly. It's a passion. And it's a passion of the flesh. It's like hatred. And if you fear hatred, and what can happen if hatred takes hold of people and they begin to act out on hatred, you should fear envy. And what can happen when people are possessed of envy and begin to act out on that? It's an ugly thing. It's rebellion against God. It's something that feeds on and feeds pride itself in people, and if taken allowed its head, it can become violent and destructive. If you look at a lot of the social movements, little subsets that fall under the category of social justice and these sorts of things that are taking place in the world today. I think as Christians we can look at those movements and recognize that they are fueled by envy. The envy of inferiors for their superiors of all different kinds. The refusal to accept that anybody should have more than I should have, that anybody should be shown a higher degree of honor than I should be shown, a refusal that anybody should have this position over me in my life, and a desire to kind of rise up by means of numbers and complaining and pitching a fit and refusing to render under those people those honors, even to strip them of them. What do you call that? That's envy. right? And we recognize that that's a sin as a Christian. So you can see that with children with respect to the authority and the honor of their parents. You can see it with wives among the respect and the authority owed to their husbands. You can see it among church members with respect to the elders, so forth and so on. That's a dangerous thing, and that's one of the consequences of irreverence taking hold in our society. Third consequence would be the domination of the least capable. Because remember that part of the reason for this ordinance for superiors is because its tendency is to put in the position of leaders those who are most capable of leading. And reverence is the acknowledgement that that's the way it is and that that's the way it ought to be and the submission unto that and the support of it. Well, when reverence dies, then what you get is not reverence shown to leaders, but irreverence, contempt, right? Rebellion. Mocking, ridiculing, trying to run the leaders down, and so when that happens, then one of the important walls comes down, which has placed the most capable in the position to lead. And so what you're going to wind up with, and what we're seeing in our society, is for example. Homes where it's the children who are making the decision and not the parents. This is what the family does. If we be honest about it, if we look at it, they do whatever Johnny wants to do. Because Johnny doesn't recognize the authority of his parents to tell him what he ought to do. Johnny's pretty sure that he ought to be telling everybody what to do, and he's willing to do things to get what he wants done that his parents aren't willing to do. And so he's now running the house. He's now totally running the show. Was that good for anybody, including Johnny? No. It's not, right? And that's part of what happens when irreverence dies. I think on a popular level, in terms of our life as a nation, that there no longer seems to be the recognition of a distinction between. People whose political opinion is worth something and those whose political opinion is worthless. The people whose political opinion is worthless, and I mean that, right? They don't understand economics, they don't understand politics. All they understand is what's in their own pocket or what's not in their own pocket. That's about as deep as their thinking goes. And those people seem to be under the impression that their voice is of equal importance in determining the political course of our country. And they will get on the social media and they'll get on the telephone to call the radio show and so forth and so on. Because everybody gets a vote, then that's the conclusion that they've drawn, that everybody's opinion is politically equal. And now we're in a position where that's a majority and they're running the show. Wow. This is not good for anybody, right? It's not good for anybody. I pity these classrooms in the colleges where the students are doing all the talking and not the professors. What a waste of time, right? And so all these things begin to happen. We get the leadership of the least capable when reverence begins to die. Sort of as a corollary to that, we will see the degradation of our leadership. Reverence. Encourages the best in our leaders, and irreverence strips them of that support and of that encouragement, and we'll see them degraded. It's one of the most distressing things about these political debates right now and the character that is taking on. What kind of a nation subjects its future leaders to the sort of public degradation that's associated with these debates? I mean, what kind of effect is this having upon these men's souls and upon their ability to lead us with anything like integrity? We're destroying our own leaders, right? And when wives treat their husbands with contempt, when children treat their fathers with contempt, when congregations treat their elders with contempt, so forth and so on, it's exactly the same effect. So that is certainly a serious consequence and something that should concern us. And then finally, coming back to number four, is the potential effect upon the worship of God. And here's what I mean. If we come to feel, as it seems that we've come to feel, that reverence is not a virtue but a vice, that reverence is just something we don't do anymore, what happens when those people enter into a worship service to worship God? If they're no longer willing to revere a superior, that's not what they do because they're too cool, or whatever it is that they think about themselves with respect to their superiors. What's going to happen to the worship of God? It's interesting to me when there's a divide in the church, and it has been for a while, among those who favor contemporary worship style and those who favor traditional worship style. It's an oversimplification of those two categories, but we'll stay with it for now. It's true generally in evangelicalism, true in the PCA in particular. And by and large, the contemporary worship style has won out. The traditional worship style is a minority. Well, if you talk to this minority of the traditional worship style camp, and you ask them, why are you holding out? Why do you favor a traditional worship style and rather than a contemporary worship style when clearly the contemporary worship style is more popular? That's what people want. These are the churches that are growing and becoming big. Why do you continue to dig in your heels and insist upon a traditional worship style? The answer that camp will give you if you listen to them is always the same thing, which is that the reason that traditional worship is important is that it is reverent. That's what they'll say. As opposed to irreverent. Sometimes they won't say that, but that's the implication, right? What's the difference between these two forms of worship? One is reverent, the other is irreverent. And the reason why it's important to stay here is we cannot allow a show of reverence towards God, that spirit, to disappear from our worship services. The consequence is unfathomable. What kind of harm that would do, both in terms of our failure as human beings to render unto God the honor and the love that He is due, and also the effect upon us as human beings when we cease to feel reverence for God. Because when we go into a worship service in which God is approached, there's no reverence shown for Him. There's some emotion in things, right? There's some sentimentality and that kind of stuff. But fairly clearly, in the music that's being played and the manner in which God is spoken of and the manner in which people dress, and that brings me back to what I was going to say last week, what's being communicated by the human beings that are involved here is whatever it is that's going on here as we're approaching God, it's not reverence. Okay, and the question is, why has that dropped out? It's a cultural phenomenon. It's because of Bart Simpson. It really is. and so that's something that I think that we ought to think about when we think about these issues. One of the things that is somewhat distressing to me is that a lot of people come to our worship services at Monroe Presbyterian Church, which we think are great. Which we think are an important part of our church, and they come once and they don't come again. All right. And if you ask people on the contemporary worship side, why is contemporary worship important? Why do you think that change needs to take place? Their answer will be because that's what people are comfortable with. If you want people to come to church, if you want people to be comfortable in your worship services, you've got to drop this traditional worship and go with the contemporary worship, the music that these people are used to listening to, the dress that these people are used to wearing in their dress, so forth and so on. And I think that potentially one of the reasons that when people come to our worship services, they're not actually comfortable with it. They're not comfortable with it. It's sort of a shock to their system, to And they may not even understand exactly why that is. And they might say, well, I don't like the organ. Or I don't like the liturgy, or whatever it is. They'll go for some superficial answer. But I think in all likelihood, part of what they don't like is the reverence. They don't like the suggestion, which is in and everything that goes on in our worship services, that God is a great superior. And the way in which he is to be approached and the way in which he is to be worshipped by human being is in showing him a profound degree of reverence. Great respect, not just tinged with awe, but shot through with awe throughout. And if you look at our culture, we've rejected that. We've rejected that spirit. We're not comfortable with that. We don't like to be made to feel that that's something that we ought to render to people, and we don't know how to do it. And so when people come into our churches and they feel that reverence being shown to God, whether they can name it or not, I think they're not comfortable with it. I think they don't like the feeling that that's what they're supposed to feel towards God. And they know very well they can go down the street to 10 other churches and not be made to feel that way. So the question is that something that you give into as the Christian church? I am perfectly capable. If that's what's driving people away from here, if that's why people come once and don't come back, I'm fine with it. I really am. Because I think that that's something that needs to be communicated to our particular society. I said last week I was going to talk about tithes. I was really just being provocative. But I do think that that this is one place, particularly when you look at that idea that the reverence to be shown to both men and God is not only to be an inward reverence of the heart, but also outward show of reverence, words and behaviors and those sorts of things. So it's important for us as Christians to think about what we're communicating to God and especially to one another. In what we decide to wear when we come to worship services. The objection is, but let me just say, in terms of my agenda as a pastor, this is real low on my priority list, so I don't talk about it a lot. I just try to set an example. So don't blow this out of proportion. But when you talk about wearing ties to church, what you usually get is, well, what if people can't afford ties? Well, in this society, that's like 1.1 of 1%. That is not the reason why people don't wear ties to church. So usually the reason that, if you press it further, it's like, well, they're uncomfortable. They choke, and it's just not pleasant. Why did our culture invent ties? Was it just to be cruel to people? It's not. The reason is because in human society, it is important sometimes to communicate this is one kind of event and this is another kind of event, mm-hmm. Right? And so we come up with different forms of dress to communicate that. And there's an interesting parable that Jesus taught about a wedding feast, where Jesus goes out and he invites people to the wedding feast, and all the first round of invitations get rejected because people are too busy. So then the guy who's holding the wedding feast invites another group, and they all come. And among those who come, one of them, it says, does not wear his wedding garments. So it's like if you were holding a wedding for your daughter, and you were trying to put on a nice event to show that, you know, this was a big deal and this was important to you, and you invited somebody, and they show up in blue jeans and a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. All right? It's disrespectful, isn't it? And so part of in receiving the invitation to come, you have a responsibility to assume not only inwardly but outwardly the spirit of it. And so if the worship of God is indeed to be not only an inward feeling of, but an outward demonstration of great reverence to the highest superior, then I think that there is indeed a place, both in the honor that we show to him and what we're seeking to promote among others around us, to consider well what our dress says about that event. I'll just leave it at that. Any comments or questions? Yes, sir.
It occurs to me that And the very first sin was that taking something that was forbidden. And there's some sort of like happiness or pride or self-satisfaction we get from doing something that the happiness in it derives from knowing we ought not do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the thing itself. It's knowing that we're thrilling ourselves to do something that is scary. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
a consequence I'm not supposed to do, but look at me, I'm doing it and I'm getting away with it.
Sure, you see it in our kids, right?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean the, we'll say romantic revolution of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The swagger of punk rock, mm-hmm. you know, thumb in your nose at anybody who's over 25, you know, like you said, I mean, I know a lot about music. And I pretty much agree. I think there's some exceptions, but by and large, that is the spirit of rock and roll is.
Mm-hmm.
I want to live fast and die young.
Mm-hmm.
That's the spirit of what it is. And there's a thrill that comes along with doing something that you're not supposed to do. So a child bucking up to an adult, or talking about your leader like he's a loser, you know, and you being very common and,
right.
I think that's at the root of a lot of this, is that same thrill that drove Eve to pluck the fruit, is knowing I shouldn't do it. I'm pretty psyched that I can do it now.
Sure.
And get away with it. There's a thrill involved with Bart Simpson, with laughing at that kind of stuff, or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So it's we are naturally inclined to be tempted by that and to succumb to that temptation. I agree. Yes, sir.
Just thinking about your comment about excuse me. Looking at what's going on within these political or presidential debates and subjecting these men to what we're subjecting them to, I think what we're seeing as an outfall of our reverence in these different spheres of society, these different institutions which God has ordained, whether it be child and parent, marriage, political realm. In this irreverence, we're seeing the lack of joy that we experience in these different institutions. And where you're seeing the outfall of that is we're abandoning all of them. So that the political sector, you no longer have wise, godly men running for these offices because you don't want to do that. You don't want to subject yourself to that. Within, we're seeing the lack of, a reproduction rate drastically decline. Why? Because our children are a burden to us now. Because we've raised and instilled in them irreverent children who aren't respectful to their parents. And statistically, 25 and under, the majority of 25 and unders now are saying they see no value in marriage. Again, why? Because we've removed the reverence in that relationship as well. And so I think it's an indicator of, by abandoning this, we've actually lost the joy that's to be found in each one of these segments of our life. And we're just abandoning them all together as a result. It's a scary thought.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
And who wants one more screaming kid in the grocery store? I mean, that's almost a joke that people make without even thinking about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Or why people look at you weird if you have more than one child.
Right. Yeah, what are you, a sadist? Yeah.
Or like you don't know how it happened.
Right. All right. Well, let's close with prayer. Lord God, we do grieve together this morning, Lord. What's happened to us as a human race and our culture here in America, and we pray, Lord, that we are not so far gone that we cannot be turned back by the way that we have come. We pray that you would have mercy upon us, Lord. To help us as the Christian people to think rightly and so think differently. Help for us to be leaders in this respect and promoters of that which is good. If the world scoffs at us, Lord, let us not be discouraged by that. And we pray that in due time, Lord, there would be a renewed appreciation of the importance of showing reverence to those to whom reverence is due. We thank you, Lord God, for your law and the wisdom that we receive through it. In Jesus' name, amen.